Today is December 1st. We're at the JCC learning Providence and Theodicy in the writings of the sages, in the writings of Chazal. And we're coming towards the end of this study.
Hooray.
It'll probably go on for 1 or 2 weeks in the new year after January. And then we'll go on, of course, to Providence and Theodicy in the writings of the Rishonim, the Middle Age authorities. A little bit Rav Sadia Gaon, we'll see. We'll see the Rambam, of course, quite a bit in the Guide to the Perplexed. We'll see the author of Sefer Chinuch, the book of Mitzvah Education, and we'll spend a number of weeks on the Ralbag. The Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, one of the most famous Jewish scientists and philosophers of the Middle Ages, also an exegete. And when we finish that, after 10, 11, 12 classes, the classes that are left will do modern Jewish philosophy on the subject of providence and theodicy in Jewish thought. Okay, so for today, instead of just continuing to add sources to the sheets you've been using, I thought I'd make a separate sheet to make it easier in your notes. So here it is, and it's about 4 sources photostated here. They're all fascinating. And I just remembered my second announcement, which is right here in front of me. I just want to tell everyone that if you're interested in reviewing just about everything you've done since the beginning of the year, it's in this book, Where is My Miracle? By Rabbi Maury Schwartz. Rabbi Schwartz just happens to be, I think, the curriculum... Yes, the curriculum director for the Worldwide Melton Program.
Right.
And he's been in Dallas to see our program here, our Melton Program, 3 times, I think, in the past 3 years. He usually teaches a class or does a faculty seminar, and I've gotten to know him the times he's been here. It turns out that our kids are friends in Israel.
What's his name again?
Maury Schwartz.
What's the name of his book?
It's called Where's My Miracle? And it turns out that Rochelle told me, Rochelle Weisgreen, she still has some copies that she's willing to sell at a reduced price. So this is not an academic book. You will not fall asleep reading it. It brings the sources that we've been studying, and then he brings like newspaper articles from our generation that bear on this subject, newspaper articles about reactions to executions, to murders, to terrorist attacks, and to things of that sort. In other words, why do bad things happen to good people? It's both a kind of conversational book, talking to you about how we feel about it, and then bringing the Talmudic sources to shed light on that. A good review of what we've been doing.
Having been to his house and having spent a 4th of July at his house, he lives in an area where he's constantly interfacing with the current problems of a boundary. There is a fence running through a field, an olive grove about 50 feet from his house, and he's furious about that. But his kids play baseball, you know. So he's
okay. Thank you, Jim. So we're going to begin our study for today, continuing where we left off. Here we are, Babylonian Talmud, the top source on the sheet, tractate Shabbat, page 13a to 13b. It is taught in the Tana de Bei Eliyahu. And even before we start, I have to explain, what is Tana de Bei Eliyahu? Well, the word Tana means teachings from the period that we call the Tannaitic period. Of course, that doesn't tell you anything. Exactly, the Mishnaic period. This is a teaching from before the year 200 of the Common Era. Debay is Aramaic, of the house of. Good morning. Right, bay in Aramaic is equivalent to the Hebrew bite. De means of. In Hebrew it would be sheh.
Yeah.
So Tana de Bei Eliyahu is a teaching from the Mishnaic period, from the house, in other words, from the schoolhouse, from the studies of the house of Eliyahu. Now the question is, who is Eliyahu? And concerning that, there is a difference of agreement. And in our particular case, it's not just a historical curiosity. It actually is going to bear on the story. Who was this Eliyahu? There are 2 possibilities. Perhaps Eliyahu was one of the Tanaim, one of the rabbis. And then it's simple. It's just like so many other titles like this. Tana de Bei Rabbi Yishmael. Tana de Bei Rabbi Yanai. We have many of them. Collections of sources from the schoolhouse of this rabbi and that rabbi, another rabbi, fine. Except that there is a tradition in the Gemara, I believe it's in Masechet Ketubot, actually I brought it here for you at the bottom, and it says it's in, yeah, Ketubot. The claim is made that the reference to Eliyahu here is not a rabbi Eliyahu, it's Eliyahu Hanavi, the prophet Eliyahu, who never died and continues to roam the world to teach things in God's name. So if that's the claim here, that Tana de Eliyahu, here are teachings that were spoken by the prophet Eliyahu, obviously the text would want us to relate to them differently than if they were teachings of a specific rabbi. Teachings of a specific rabbi, there might be other rabbis that disagree. But if it's the prophet Eliyahu, we probably are supposed to, in the eyes of the text, relate to it with a bit more, with much more respect and deference. We'll see that's important as we read on with this amazingly relevant story.
Which is it? In other words, it's whatever you want to assume, right?
We don't know.
What year did you say prior? This is a teaching prior to.
Not to say you know.
200 of the Common Era. Mishneic, Tanaitic teachings. It means before the year 200 of the Common Era. Here we go. It once happened that a certain scholar, a Talmid Chacham, who had studied much Bible and Mishnah, and had served scholars much, and served scholars means that he continued to participate in the scholarly debates, what we call today Talmud, not just Bible, not just Mishnah, but what we call Talmud, discussion, further discussion, deeper discussion on the basic halachic teachings, yet died in middle age. He died much earlier than people usually died. A tragedy happened to a great Torah scholar. His wife took his tefillin and carried them about in the synagogues and schoolhouses and complained to them. It is written in the Torah, quote, "For that is thy life and the length of thy days." It says in the book of Deuteronomy that the Torah is your life and length of days. In other words, as we've seen many times, the Torah says it promises a long life. And here was a person who did everything we're supposed to do, and he died before his time. My husband, who read Bible, learned Mishnah, skip the footnotes and go to the continuation of the text, and served scholars much, why did he die in middle age? So she went to the great men of the generation, at least those in her town and area, and asked. She complained, she cried. Well, we don't know if she was emotional. We don't know if she lost it, if she was going around crying and screaming and begging for answers. We don't know if she was bitter. We don't know if she was quiet and rational, asking philosophic questions. We don't know what, but clearly she was disturbed by the issues that are bothering us in this class. Why do bad things happen to very good people? Why did she bring the tefillin with her? Well, perhaps because they're the only Judaic object she had at home. I mean, they didn't have books then. She didn't have any written documentation that her husband studied. She couldn't bring a book that he wrote or the library he'd been studying from. But tefillin, she had.
Did they wear talit in
there? Did they wear a talit?
Yeah. Back then?
Yeah, but a talit, again, is not a written record. But the tefillin have parchment in them. Perhaps she brought it with her just to remind them who her husband was and that he was a scholar. Or perhaps she was saying, like in the modern... how some people do things today. Check his tefillin, you'll see there's nothing wrong with them.
They're kosher.
But whatever, on some level, she was bothered, she was distraught, she was pained, not just by the tragedy of the loss of her husband, but by the theological issue. How could this be? God promised that he should live a long life. And then the Talmud says, and no man could answer her. That's amazing.
What happened here is...
Skip the footnotes.
No. 23, 24, 25, and 26 are
the footnotes. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. No, okay.
And no man could answer her. And that's pretty amazing. Because we have seen in this class that in different generations, in different locales, our sages offered many and sundry answers to the question of why do bad things happen to good people. We've seen the idea that there must be some sin somewhere if someone died. We've seen the idea that he's having his tiny sins burned off so he can have a clean slate in Olam Haba, the next world. We've seen so many different suggestions. But in this particular generation, in this particular locale, despite the fact that she went to great teachers of Torah, no one could answer her. And, well, what does that mean?
It means she didn't believe in God.
I don't think that's what it means. What I think it means is that in that particular case, in that particular place, the Torah teachers did not accept, or at least couldn't apply in this case, some of those very standard and pat answers that we've learned about. They could have said, oh, he was being punished for the sins of his father or his grandfather. They could have said it was a burn-off for Olam Haba. They could have said lots of different things, but they didn't. And to me, that's significant that they didn't. They were willing to leave it without an answer. They just said, we don't understand. We don't know.
So what they were saying is God chose it. But she didn't accept it.
Perhaps they were saying that God chose it. We don't know the answer. Perhaps they were saying we don't even know if God chose it. But it's significant because we have to remember that we've seen so many different answers. But it doesn't mean that all those answers were accepted in all the different generations and all different places. They were, this answer was spoken then and then so spoken then. But at this particular time, in this particular place, they didn't accept any of those answers. Even though it would be easy to say, he must have sinned sometime. There's no man in the world who's so righteous that never sins. And God is middakdek bechasidav adchut asara, that God is exacting with his righteous into a hair's breadth. They could have said that, but no one did.
He was such an important person during his lifetime. They knew who he was.
Apparently.
And they couldn't find anything wrong with him.
Apparently.
Apparently he was really a righteous man.
Yeah.
And they all, out of deference, said nothing. In no way to destroy his
reputation. But also, again, they could have given different types of answers. Say it's to give him a greater reward in Olam Haba. They didn't say anything.
I would argue with Bruce for just a second. Doesn't say he was a righteous man. Doesn't say it. It says he studied. We don't know whether he beat it. It doesn't tell us whether he beat his wife.
I think the implication of this type of literature to say someone's a Talmid Chacham.
What this implies then, and I'm not arguing with against it, what this implies then is studying Bible and Mishnah and serving the scholars then assumes that one of the results of that is to be a righteous person.
It certainly does.
Yeah,
it certainly does.
Behave ethically and do all the right things.
And we'll see mention of that in another few lines.
Well, they didn't have a valid answer. After all, they were taught, you know, a certain way, and this comes up, and they're scratching their heads, you know, for a valid answer. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have a valid answer. So if you don't have a valid answer, you just don't give one.
Yeah, and to me that's important to remember, because we've seen so many different answers, and don't think that all the rabbis accepted any or all of those answers. Let's go on. On one occasion, I was a guest at her house. And when I read that word I, we go back to what I mentioned 5 minutes ago. We don't know who the author of this collection of stories was. Was it a rabbi by the name of Eliyahu? Or is it supposed to be the prophet Eliyahu? So when it says, I was a guest at her house, does it mean that a certain rabbi by the name of Eliyahu was a guest at her house? Or does it mean that the prophet Eliyahu, in the guise of a man, made a visit to her house for some reason? And we'll see why that's important. So I'm reading on. On one occasion, I was a guest at her house, and she related the whole story to me. Now, she saw as a rabbi, whether a prophet in the guise of a rabbi, or really a rabbi, and she spilled her heart out to me. She told me how great her husband was, all the study he did, all the good deeds he did, all the mitzvot he did, and how one day he just died. And she said, I'm distraught, I don't understand God's ways here. And I asked all the rabbis in the town, and no one had a good answer for me. Said I to her, my daughter, and that's a term of endearment that the older man is speaking to this woman who's probably in her early 30s, who just lost her husband. My daughter, how was he to thee in the days of menstruation? In other words, he's checking to see if this rabbi who passed away, her husband, really, really, really kept all the mitzvot and all their little minutia. And what did she say? God forbid, he did not touch me even with his little finger. So it looks like this rabbi fulfilled all the laws, even those laws that no one from the outside would know. Right? That's the point. Because he's asking specifically about this, because everything else is public. But this is private. Perhaps here we'll find the source of his sin. Here we'll understand why God took him, because of sin. But the rabbi or the prophet can't find, even in the hidden recesses of his private life, can't find any sin. But the rabbi or the prophet, whoever it is, doesn't relent. And how was he to thee in the days of white garments? Which means the following. Make a long, long, long story short. According to the way the halakha has been understood for a long time, there's an obligation of separation between husband and wife, not only during the days of Nidah, the days of menstruation, but often for also for 7 days afterwards. And those are called the days of white. And our answer was, he ate with me, he drank with me, and slept with me in bodily contact, and it did not occur to him to be intimate with me. In other words, we kept the law of not having intimacy, but we didn't refrain from physical contact of other kinds. And that's problematic. And then look what I said to her. Blessed be the omnipresent for slaying him that he did not condone on account of the Torah. Which means that even though this man was a great scholar, God did not condone this minor infraction. This infraction that might only be the Rabbanan, that might only be rabbinic, he didn't condone this little infraction, but he killed the scholar for the sin. And I am saying, whether it's Eliyahu the prophet or Eliyahu the rabbi, that blessed be God, he found out even the minor sins of the holy ones and punished them. For lo, the Torah hath said, and thou shalt not approach unto a woman as long as she is impure by her uncleanliness. And since she wouldn't have gone to the mikveh until the end of the 7 days, therefore, she should not be approached. And it's not clear whether it's deraita or derabbanan that don't approach means not only sexual intimacy is forbidden, but any type of physical nearness. So whether it's deraita or derabbanan...
Is it nearness or touching?
Touching. So the sin has been found out, as it were. And everything is clear now. We understand that he was punished for his sins. Except for the next line.
Now what?
When Ravdimi came, and that means when Ravdimi came from the land of Israel to the study houses in the land of Babylon, he said it was a broad bed. What that means is that the bed they slept in was so big that they were allowed to sleep in the same bed,
but they wouldn't touch
each other. And they wouldn't touch each other. So everything was fine. Then there is no sin here.
But that's not what she said. She said, and he slept with me in bodily contact.
So what the Hebrew says, kiruv basar, which literally means closeness of flesh, and we're being told it doesn't mean literally, it means that there was no, that we're in the same bed.
Yeah.
But the rabbi's saying it was the same bed, but it was totally legal, it was totally permitted, because it was a big bed and there was a space between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk more about this as soon as I finish reading. In the West, which means in the land of Israel, they said, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef said, a divider was set between them. It was the same bed, but they put something in the middle. And that also made it completely and absolutely legal. now. Wait a second. What's happening here? Let's understand what's happening in this story.
They're trying to prove that he didn't die because of any sin.
Of course you're right. But how could they say the things they're saying? Let's go back and analyze. Wait a second. Let's go step by step. We said that we don't know exactly who this Eliyahu is. Is it a rabbi or is it a prophet who's come to do God's work on earth? So let's say that it's a rabbi. It's a rabbi. So we hear this story that the rabbi talked to her and the rabbi found out from her own description. Let me say it differently. The rabbi heard her description and came to the conclusion that there was a certain sin here, and that's why the man died. He was killed for a sin. Now that, of course, gives us an easy, pat, clear answer to what happened. And everything is fine. We have a theologically acceptable answer that's going to satisfy the woman and satisfy the readers, and everything is fine. And then come these two rabbis and then ruin it. They ruin it. And they ruin it, I assume, not on the basis of knowledge. They weren't there in the bedroom. How do they know? The answer is they don't know. All they're doing is they're judging him favorably. They're saying it must be, if he was such a scholar, how could he have done this? There must have been a divider in the bed. It must have been a big bed. There must be some explanation. Now, it's true. There's a mitzvah to judge others favorably. But here, in fulfilling that mitzvah, they're destroying a theological answer that could have been satisfying.
It was a packed answer.
And we have to ask ourselves, why would they go out of their way, not on the basis of knowledge, to destroy a good theological answer? And the answer has to be that they didn't accept the answer. There's no other way to look at it. So we see here clearly, that at least two rabbis are disturbed by the suggestion that God goes out of his way to punish righteous people for minor sins. So we have to understand that just as there are rabbis that give answers, there are other rabbis that are not willing to accept those answers. We see here a clear statement that I think is unequivocal, that particular theological approach that says that wherever there is suffering, there must have been sin. Wherever there's death, there must have been iniquity. And as small as is, we can find it out and everything will make sense. No, these two rabbis say that there can be death without sin. And that brings us back to the passage we had seen earlier, right? That discussed the question, is there suffering without sin? Is there death without iniquity? And came to the conclusion, yes, there is such a thing in rare cases. And here is a normal run-of-the-mill case where we do have the possibility of saying that it was a sin. We have a certain evidence, her own words, that there was a sin here, but some rabbis go out of the way to say there's no sin, and therefore we have to say that there was death without sin. So then why? If it's death without sin, then what's the reason? No, we don't know. But the point is that we can say death without sin. So now yes, and then...
Another way of possibly of looking at it is that this is a neat legalism that sticks with the theology, which sticks with the halakha regarding nida, and says, here's a way, and if you don't live in a big house with more than one room, more than two rooms maybe, and you only have one bed, how do you manage to sleep without getting into trouble with the Almighty?
That's true.
The way to do it is to put down a board in between, which, by the way, was done in the United States.
Well, I do it all the time.
Morning bed.
Yeah. It goes in the bazoom crits.
Yeah. No, but it was done in colonial when boys and girls had to sleep together in the same bed.
Really?
They put down a bedding board.
I know.
Yeah.
So that means
so
you're bored in bed.
You're bored in bed, right? but this then deals legally, and if you will, theologically, the theological question of why do bad things happen is we don't know. We don't know. But this establishes halacha.
It's true. It's true. First, we have Chip here.
If you can look at it that he had no sin, but he died early so that he can enjoy the world to come as early as possible and as for as long as possible.
Right, except that no rabbi said that to her.
That's my comment.
Right? No rabbi said that to her.
Rabbi
Chip did.
Chip did.
I think that...
It seems to me that the emphasis on this is, again, misplaced, because the real moral question here is whether or not, let's even assume that the rabbi had violated that one commandment by virtue of being in contact with his wife during the 7-day period. The issue to me, as far as looking at right and wrong and so forth, that there's no justice here, because the punishment is so far excessive based upon the presumed infraction. I would think that that would be the moral issue that should be, that they would have debated. Obviously they didn't, unless we're coming to it. And rather than the technicality.
So Jay, it could be, we don't know, but it could be that what you're saying actually plays into the story. Because when the rabbis at the end say what they say, it was a broad bed or there's a divider, perhaps they're saying exactly what you just said. They're responding to the story that this great man was killed by God for this infraction. And they're saying, Gewalt! That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And therefore, it's better to say there was no infraction and we don't know what's going on. It could be that that's part of it. Joe was first.
I just thought it was kind of interesting because this whole process seems to be a very, very typical process in that a statement is made or a position is taken and a rabbi or rabbis don't agree with it. And since they don't agree with it, they have to have a reason for not agreeing with it. So they find some excuse in either biblical writings or teachings of the past or the Torah or wherever to support their non-belief.
Yes, clearly they did not have physical evidence that the bed was big or there was a divider.
So they came up with something that says...
Well, that's true. It's an effort to think of a possible scenario that will make sense.
I'm wondering if this translation is correct in the story, because in the one case she says, he did not touch me even with his little finger. In the next sentence it says, he slept with me in bodily contact.
So that's what Mo asked earlier.
I
explained that in the translation, the words are kiruv basar, literally closeness of flesh. And it looks like that Eliyahu interpret that to mean physical contact. Mm-hmm. Whereas the rabbis say it doesn't mean physical contact. It means nearness, but not necessarily physical contact.
Right.
And the Hebrew phrase is really unclear.
Okay.
You know,
I think we're in that over there.
Are we seeing the first signs of liberal thinking here from Rabbi Dimi?
If by liberal you mean a skepticism with some of the pat answers,
yes.
Then the answer is yes.
Okay.
I don't think we have to call that liberal thinking.
Well, what do you call it then? I agree with Bruce.
Yeah,
I think he's right.
Because all the others are just traditionalists.
Right.
Okay, but again,
give me that old time.
Okay, but again, we have seen this is not the first time we've seen this. We saw the passage that began with the assertion there is no suffering without sin, there is no death without iniquity, and that passage ended with refutation. There's a last word, refutation. There is death without iniquity. And this is another statement a very powerful statement of the same thing.
You know, in today's world, how many of us who have gone to funerals where the rabbi says, if it's a death at a young age, you know, really, the rabbi is delivering the eulogy, the priest, any clergy today.
Yeah.
How could this happen to such a young, beautiful?
I've actually heard a eulogy for a 15 or 16 year old girl that passed away, and the rabbi's eulogy. Within his eulogy, she was pure. She passed away, and she was in a pure state. Where did the comment?
I think your wife is in front of you, before you. Stephanie, did you want to say something?
I'm curious.
Sorry, Jim.
I don't have much religion in me. I wasn't raised with it. So today, is it still so important to have separate beds? Because I'm thinking in crowded situations, most people don't go to another room. So, I mean, what happened in Israel when the Ethiopians came, the women rioted. At the old Panai was in the hotel.
I was there.
Okay, so you remember, because they looked around and they said, where's the separate house for us? And there wasn't any.
Okay, so although it's
the first time I really thought they'd take it serious.
Although it's not our subject, I'll say a word about that.
I'm curious.
In the modern consumerist world, where there is a gadget and a solution to every problem, and I don't know if this has been going on for 50 years or 80 years, I don't know, but there are beds that it's a big bed for husband and wife, but it's not one big mattress, it's two separate mattresses.
It's like a hotel.
Wait a second. Let me finish. And the one or both of the mattresses, although you can't see this by looking at it, are on sliding riders. And they move aside. And then they put back. That's your simple technical answer.
I just remember them being
okay.
So
Jim wanted to say something?
Still.
It's okay, Jim. We're reformed.
When does it come about, accepting that bad things happen to good people? Does it come about that instead of accepting that, you go out and really find out why, to solve the diseases and the old age problems and the dimness and the cataract surgery and everything like that? Because it's very definite in the Jewish mind to do that. It's pointed out by the fact that in the last Nobel Prize winners in science, out of 7 of them, 5 of them are Jewish. When there's 12 billion Jews in the world, there's 7 billion people. 7 billion people in the world, there's only 12 million Jews. So where does this come about that instead of accepting this, you go out and find reasons for it and change it and correct it?
Yeah. I often think about what Jim just brought up, that the theology we're studying, in my mind, to a large degree, is a function of the level of, or the lack of, scientific thinking and the lack of technology. They lived in a world in which things that had no explanation happened all the time. They lived in a world in which most people who were born did not reach the age of 20, right?
You don't get the development of science until about the 15th
right,
century.
Right, so Jim's question really relates to when did the what we call the mode of scientific empirical thinking, when did it develop? And that's not necessarily a Jewish matter, that's more general.
I grew out of the schools of philosophy in ancient Greece.
No,
yeah.
It's later than that.
So let's leave that aside, but what we will see in these sources is there are certainly rabbis, I left these all for the end, there are certainly rabbis who say that things happen for natural causes that are unrelated to behavior and morality and purpose.
But there are elements of this, obviously in this, of the scientific method, the very simple ones were wash your hands before eating, which made a dramatic difference.
I don't think there's any evidence that washing one's hands before eating in the Talmud is a function of any understanding of disease or germs.
Practical matter, it was. And the same reason about Odoni's pork.
Not to be with dead.
Again, I don't think that is stated as a reason. But again, it's another can of kosher worms.
But it was an element of some.
I'm not sure that you're right.
Washing hands was important in the 19th century in the United States.
Rabbi Zeck's class yesterday. Things happen because of muscles.
Yes, and we're also going to get to that.
But muscles, constellation, it's not luck.
Right.
But mazal does rest asunder the connection between what happens to you and your behavior. That it does rest it asunder and say it's a given.
It's also the stars.
That's the point. If it's the stars, it's not because of God specifically acting towards you for a purpose. It's just the way things were created. But that will leave for another few more weeks.
The bottom line, it seems to me, is that this is a discussion. These are discussions about God's intervention on the individual level.
Yes, exactly. So now, before we put this source aside and go to the next one, remember there's a dangling string that we have to go back to, which is the following. I had said that it's not clear who this Eliyahu is. Either it's a rabbi or it's Eliyahu Hanavi, Eliyahu the prophet, according to the text. Now, until now, we've been discussing on the basis of the assumption that it's a rabbi. So we said one rabbi said that he died because of his sin. And two other rabbis said, no, it can't be. He didn't die because of his sin. Fine, we had a discussion, but now let's go back. What happens if we want to read this text according to the assumption that the Eliyahu discussed here is Eliyahu Hanavi, Eliyahu the prophet?
But wouldn't they have written that? When the great Eliyahu...
No, it could be, because it begins with Tana de Eliyahu.
So
we have to know that Tana de Eliyahu is the events and the pronouncements of Eliyahu the prophet. And therefore, when it says, I was a guest at our house, it means Eliyahu, as many times he does, came down to earth and appeared as a human being, and he was a guest at our house. Now, if that's what's going on, then when Eliyahu says, blessed be the omnipresent for slaying him, well, that's Eliyahu the prophet. And if he said that, how can we, the rabbis, object? In other words, if these two rabbis at the end of the story heard that Eliyahu said that God killed him for his sin, how could they say, Eliyahu, you're wrong? It wasn't because of his sin, really, it was a broad bed or there was a divider set between them. How can these rabbis object? That's a serious question, and I want to give you a possible answer that I saw in this book by Rabbi Mori Schwartz.
Didn't they question what is either of the Eliyahus doing at her house?
Well,
asking her these questions?
He came as a guest. He was a great rabbi. And since he was a great rabbi, or in the guise of a great rabbi, they got into discussion, and she asked her theological questions, and they got into details. That makes sense. So anyway, how could we understand this story if the rabbis are commenting after hearing that Eliyahu himself, the great Eliyahu the prophet, said that this person was killed by God for his sins? So Rabbi Schwartz suggests that what they must be saying is the following. Again, how could they disagree with Eliyahu? So they're probably saying the following, that Eliyahu said to her not the truth, but what she needed to hear.
Compassion.
Not the truth, but what she needed to hear. And what these two rabbis are telling us at the end is exactly that. They're saying, look, even Eliyahu would have known that it was a broad bed, because he's the prophet. There was a broad bed, or there was a divider. But what he said to her was in order to comfort her. Because he knows, being Eliyahu, what she needed to hear. And he got into the whole discussion with her in order to create the opportunity to say what he wanted to say, which was that there's justice in the world and God killed your husband because of his sin, and that would, he knew, comfort her. So the rabbis are not disagreeing with Eliyahu. They're saying that Eliyahu knew what we're saying. But we want to make it clear to you that Eliyahu knew that to teach you. So what's the end of all this? The end of all this is that really even Eliyahu would agree. Even Eliyahu the prophet agrees that there was no more reasons for what happened. But we have to add into the mix the following new element from this way of reading the story, that it's permissible to present and suggest answers to the theological question even when we know them not to be true. Because people sometimes have to hear a white lie for their own good.
But that would lead that path is so slippery slope. I'm sorry. You can keep the light on so your two children at sundown on Friday, so your two children who were coming in from a picnic can find their way home, and you're going to turn and you're going to keep on turning the lights on and off.
Let me stop it for a second. That brings up the whole issue of, do the ends justify the means? Am I allowed to transgress, in this case, lie, for a noble end, for a purpose? And that's a big discussion in Talmudic thought. It's about lying, it's about stealing to save someone from disease. There is so much there. It actually is focused in the Torah portion of 2 weeks ago, when we see that Jacob stole and lied for a higher purpose, to save the Jewish people, get the blessing from his father. But it's not for us to discuss now. In any case, it's not for us to discuss now.
I never heard that one before.
That is the... No, I'm not going to say anything.
Now you got a new one.
I'm not going to say anything.
Kosher.
Exactly. So to close our discussion of this story, whether we read it that it was Eliyahu the rabbi, whether we read it was Eliyahu the prophet, the conclusion seems to be that... there is a strong basis to object to pat theological answers and to say that we have no answers. And just like we said many times in the discussion the past half an hour, there are many answers available, but apparently at least some rabbis in some generations felt it better to say nothing, to say that there just could be death without sin, than to suggest suggestions of little sins that might have been the cause.
So it has to be a big sin.
Perhaps, perhaps not, we don't know. So let's go on.
Well, you know, if you take, for example, the terrible disease of cancer, just for example, most people live, you know, clean lives, you know, nowadays, and they take their vitamins, they eat the right kind of foods, yet some people go through life never getting cancer, others will get cancer. And so using that as an example, for example, a person could say, well, those people that are getting cancer because somehow, without knowingly, they sin. See my point? I'm trying to make a comparison here. But then you can say, but then someone else can say, no, they got cancer. Whatever reason, we don't know. Even the doctors don't even know why. Some get cancers and others don't get cancer, especially two people living in the same house, eating the same foods, living equalized, parallel lives, and so forth and so on. So it's the same kind of an argument as this is. I'm trying to bring it down to a modern way of thinking.
And indeed, in these modern cases, people very often are looking for answers. And like I said, in this book, he actually brings newspaper articles and interviews with people who had relatives killed in terrorist attacks or have died of cancer, and he talks about the theological search, and this person says God took him for a better world, and this one says he must have sinned someplace, and then we read the newspaper articles, and he connects them to the sources here in this book.
But the answer to that is we go find out why they have cancer and why they die of cancer. And we see it coming out of Israel all the time. You know, this, the research such in our lifetime, such dramatic changes. And you see it even, you see it every day in the fact of, like in the New York Times today, the big issue about now is that to sequence the human genome where 25 years ago it would cost you $50 million to do it, and only two or three people were doing it. Now you can do it for $1,000, and you can research it, and we're finding dramatic things on cancer on an almost daily basis to solve these issues. So that's the answer to it. No, don't accept it, but go find out why, and
do something better.
And do something about it. The same way about why do people get killed by terrorist bombings? We go out and we build the separation wall so they won't get in.
Some would agree with you, Jim, and some would disagree.
Why so there's Amos Oz and there's us.
Because some would say that science and religion are asking the same question.
Yes.
And the more science gives an answer, the less room there is for religion to give an answer. Uh-huh. Others would say that science and religion are asking two different questions. Science is asking the question on the level of physical causation. Why did this happen? And religion is asking a different question. What is the meaning of it? And this second group of people would say that even if and when you have all the scientific answers, you still have the religious questions. Okay, but what's the purpose of it? What's the deeper meaning of it? Why did God arrange it in this fashion that people who are born with certain genes die earlier from certain diseases? And I think we should know that there are these two ways of looking at it, that science and religion are on the same level, and others will say, no, they're asking different questions, and science will never, ever obviate the need, at least of some human beings, to ask questions on a different, deeper level of theology. The next story...
I didn't get what annoys me. Is those two rabbis having to make a decision reminds me of the morals police in Jerusalem.
No, it was after the fact, after he was dead, they were judging favorably.
These men interfering.
They're not interfering. She's dead.
She's dead.
She went all around town.
Yeah, let's go on to the next story. Babylonian Talmud Tractate Shabbat, page 33b.
Where are
the top of the back of the page.
Oh, 33b.
For Rabbi Gurion, others state Rabbi Yosef, son of Rabbi Shemaya, said, when there are righteous men in the generation, the righteous are seized by death for the sins of the generation. When there are no righteous in the generation, school children are seized for the generation.
Right.
Here's another answer. It's the answer of vicarious atonement.
Like a sacrifice.
It's grotesque.
Right? People ask the question, especially they ask the question, when little children die, what sin could they have? And this particular short Talmudic passage gives an answer. Does it have a basis in the Torah? Well, remember, we certainly have the idea of one generation dying for the sins of others, right? We know in the Ten Commandments. There we got the impression that it was descendants and people who are related. Here it doesn't say that. It's just the righteous and then the school. Why the school children, by the way? Because they're righteous. In other words, the more righteous you are, the pure you are, the more eligible you are to be a vicarious sacrifice for someone else.
Like Ma'alot?
Well.
Ma'alot.
Ma'alot, yeah, I mean. Convince me.
I'm not trying to convince you. I'm presenting to you possibilities and sources.
The basic Jewish teaching that I was taught all my life, that Jews teach the most important thing there is life.
Right. We say l'chaim.
To save one life is to save the world. And so if life is the most basic thing there is, why punish the righteous?
To save the many. In other words, God here is a whole generation of people and they're sinning. He doesn't want to kill them all, but he has to do something. Justice demands that God react. So he kills a few righteous and that allows him to save the million mediocre, normal, everyday human beings. I'm not trying to convince you, Harry. I'm trying to explain what this source holds.
It's so irrational.
I'm happy that you're passionate about it.
My Jewish approach, it's so irrational.
It's not irrational. It
yes,
makes
it
sense on its own terms.
Where's the rationalization?
Where's the irrationality?
I know the irrationalization to say is it saves all these others. You know, that's bullcorn. Come on.
You used the term justice demands.
Yes, I did.
God do something.
Yes, I did.
But this is not justice.
Why not?
This is because it is unjust to punish the innocent. That is a fundamental concept, almost like in an axiom in geometry. If I go back to Rabbi Aliyah, I forgot his name.
It's okay.
In
the
driven leaf, in which he was attracted to Euclidean geometry, that's what I'm trying to think of. It's an axiom that this is injustice on its basis thing, mm-hmm. cannot be used as a rationale for a bigger justice. It's unjust.
The answer is collective identity.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it just, though.
Yes, it does.
No.
Because you're assuming that the fundamental unit of identity is the individual.
Yeah.
And if you make that assumption, then you're right. But if you assume that I am part of my family, and my family is part of my clan, and my clan is part of the town, and the town is part of the people of Israel, we're all in some sense one organic unit, then just like we could punish my left hand for the sins of my right, so we could punish, or we can search for vicarious atonement, by killing one member of the unit, of the identity, collective identity for the other.
Amputate a toe.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave the children.
Rabbi, that logic would then have to, for it to be correct, that the punishment of the innocent would have to exert some influence on those that weren't to make them better.
No, it saves their lives.
Yes.
It saves their lives from God's wrath.
But it doesn't make them better.
But it saves their lives.
But very simple. You know, every time...
But it would be more logical and more just to punish the wicked.
Of course.
But it would be too cruel, because God would have to wipe out...
No,
70%.
Wipe them out.
But no. God is a merciful God.
No, he's not.
That's the contradiction exactly in my argument.
Setting.
You have just said is not merciful.
Joe would say it's merciful to amputate my toe to save my life.
I was just giving an example. I wasn't stating an opinion.
Okay.
If the toe was diseased, that's one thing. If the toe were diseased, or a limb, you have to amputate to save
the whole people is diseased. They're all, the 80% are sinning. What is God going to do?
The 80% and the remaining 20 will be pure and they will carry on. I mean, that's the logical thing to do. That's mercy. Why would you be merciful to those who are sinners?
Because we're all part of one unit.
Right. Well, it's very simple.
If it's Sodom and Gomorrah.
Jay, I know. I understand what's going on inside of you.
I'm just saying, though, that it's the argument that, and in fact, I would think that this guy,
be respectful,
and others, I guess that's R for Rabbi.
Yes, in other words, there's an argument who actually said this.
Said,
yes.
I would ablate him from the Mishnah, from the Talmud.
What is that word? Ablate?
Ablate.
Erase.
Redact.
Get rid of him.
Eliminate. Never quote him.
Put a footnote.
It would be a sin to mention his name to say something.
Right, because this makes, you know, this makes a travesty of the Nuremberg trial.
That's okay.
I mean, evil should just be accepted, because that way it saves some of the people. Kill the, why not just take the lives of the evil? Why don't we have any books ever written, why do good things happen to bad people? Instead of why do bad things
same thing.
Happen to, no, there's a little shift there.
Jim?
No, I always use the example of every time an IDF soldier goes out.
Say again, Jim.
Every time a member of the IDF, a young man
goes
IDF, out.
IDF, yes.
And risk his life for the rest of the Jewish people. And he occasionally they get killed. What they're doing is he's the righteous and he dies slowly.
No. He's in the, I'm a, come on, I was in World War II.
I know.
You know, you're fighting, the difference between being a soldier and fighting for your country. That's no compliment. There are a lot of soldiers that were not righteous. Just because you're a soldier doesn't mean you're righteous.
Yeah, you're, right, but
does it in Israel?
No. If you're a soldier for the IDF, if you're a soldier for the IDF, it you're does. Definition, you're righteous.
Well, Jim is pointing out something very powerful that we discussed many classes ago, that the idea of collective identity is extremely difficult for modern human beings to accept. It flies in the face of a basic intuition that's been inculcated and ingrained in us for a generation. And we call it irrational or unjust. It's hard for us to see this other truth that was so basic to the ancient world. Jim is pointing out that there's one place in modern life where we're still able to get our arms and our minds around the concept of collective identity, and that's war.
And also the state of Israel gives a collective identity.
There we understand.
What?
In war we understand.
What you're trying to make?
The fact that a soldier goes and kills another soldier.
Right.
The soldier he's killing didn't do anything wrong.
Oh.
Necessarily did not. You don't even know him. But wait a second. But we justify it.
I'm killing someone who's trying to kill me.
Not necessarily. He might be sitting there in the barracks and making lunch for the other soldiers. But you send a missile in his direction, or a sniper points a rifle at him. Why? How do we justify this? Because he's part of a collective that's trying to annihilate us.
Yes.
Even though he himself, perhaps not. And just like we understand and we accept that we kill people who are innocent because they're part of a collective that is guilty.
No.
In the same sense, we accept that soldiers can be killed.
Way out in left field. Come on,
soldiers can be killed.
There are different connotations.
It's part of a collective.
As to how you live, rules and regulations living in peace and rules and regulations during a war. They're like day and night. And you can't put them on the same scale. You just can't put them on the same scale, what you're trying to do.
I think that in this case we can. But everyone will listen and decide.
Well, you've never been in a war then.
Well, I actually have.
How many of you have ever fought in a war?
In Hezbollah attacks the state of Israel, they're trying to destroy the Jewish people. That's what's happening. Every time Hezbollah sends a rocket into Israel, they're trying to destroy the Jewish people.
Go ahead.
I want to move, since I'm not a military expert, I want to get back to Stephanie's remarks about the Nuremberg trials. One of the things that we're commanded to do, not that we might do, but that we're commanded to do, is to kill the pursuer.
Kill what?
Kill somebody who wants to murder somebody else.
Right.
Not just me. But if I see my neighbor being pursued, a guy with a gun running after my neighbor, I'm commanded to shoot him and kill him.
You are commanded to take
this. I am commanded by halacha to shoot him, to kill him. It's one of the three things. Men running to kill, somebody trying to kill somebody else, somebody who's involved in incest, and somebody
involved
in
idolatry.
Yes,
the incest. Well, down here it says, the Holy One, blessed be He, does not test the wicked, but only the righteous.
We'll get to that.
I don't have to agree with what it says.
I think that's the key point.
Okay.
And so we're getting excited about what's supposed to be true or not true, what's right and what's wrong. Really, all we're doing is looking at these different folks' opinions. We don't have to agree with them.
No.
And all we have to do is say, hey, I don't agree with it. And I don't think he's logical.
Right.
And then we go on to the next one.
We should try to understand. Hey, Chip.
In Sodom and Gomorrah, the evil were destroyed, and the more righteous Lot and his family were preserved. Now, if we're going to go by the theology that the righteous should suffer for the wicked, then Lot and his family should have been killed, and the rest of the city survived.
Right, Chip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
I think that you're right. In other words, here we have a different approach. Let me just mention before we go on two things. One is that let's see the source we're reading now in the context of other sources we've seen that were trying to figure out why the righteous suffer more than others. Remember going back, for example, to the Bar Kokhba period, when it's specifically the righteous that were suffering. Because they studied Torah, because they kept the mitzvot, the Romans were pursuing them. Here's another effort to understand why sometimes it looks like Dafka, specifically those who are better, have a worse fate. And the answer is, in this particular case, because they are defending, in a certain sense, they're defending with their death the masses. They're dying so we can live. And if that reminds you a little bit of some parts of Christian theology,
they get it from Isaiah,
of the suffering servant, of Jesus who dies for the sins of the world, well, indeed, we have it in Isaiah, and I put here on the sheet, Yeshayahu 57:1. I'm sorry, I didn't put on the sheet. The Isaiah I'm thinking of is 51 or 52, right? The suffering servant.
53.
53, okay. 53. The traditional Jewish understanding of the suffering servant in Isaiah is that the suffering servant is the Jewish people, who as a collective are suffering for the sins of the world. And here you have that same idea taken to the individual, that the righteous individuals in each generation may be suffering in order to atone for the sins of others. And the same thing with the school children who are pure of no sins. Their death atones for many, many, many sins of the others who are still kept alive. Okay, let's go on to another source.
Just a point though, but this would almost be like human sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To adopt this, something that Judaism is absolutely opposed to. That idea, the sacrifice of innocent children for the benefit of somebody else, how different is that from societies that actually did that?
Well, I would say the difference is it's not human beings deciding to kill, it's God. To me, that makes all the difference in the world.
Exactly. I mean, God was about to make a point with the sacrifice of Isaiah, right? Of Isaac. But he didn't do that. And
we don't
know it
that.
Is so contradictory to assume that this could possibly even be considered. I don't know.
But again, there's a big difference between humans sacrificing humans and God sacrificing humans. Of course, you're right that we do not sacrifice human beings, but that has nothing to do with God's ways.
You have to expand that.
I will say that God has a lot to atone for.
The point is that if he's taking the innocent, then as Chip has reminded us from time and time and time again, it's so that they'll have a better afterlife.
Well, that's not necessarily here in the source.
No, but that's one way to look at it.
Yeah. But if you take the source in a vacuum, it's just saying that the innocent suffer for the good of the collective.
Right,
not that they get anything better.
Well, let me, like a broken record. Gee, that's an interesting idea. I don't have to agree with it, period.
That's true.
One last little point.
Okay, and then Harry?
We should go on. But this is so anti-Darwinian. If you kill the righteous, to atone for it is opposite to the natural laws that we as we understand them today.
Right.
But you didn't have to understand them then. Logic would tell you that if you kill the righteous and leave, let the unrighteous prevail, you'll have more unrighteous people. It's not going to make them more righteous to kill the righteous. You mean we've even said that today? And so by that token, you're just going to breed, in a sense, I don't mean biologically breed, but have an environment that the unrighteous will flourish and populate the earth.
I hear.
I think...
Wait, Harry's waiting to speak.
Rabbi Jay is right.
First of all, I agree with Jay 100%.
Yes, we all do.
So tell me, what is the statement that the Bible says, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, justice, justice shall you pursue. This is justice.
Okay, you've made your point.
Okay, let's go back to the scientific method. What you guys are doing is quite consistent. You're providing the counterfactual, the argument against. Now, these are rabbis that are saying that if they want to attribute it to the prophet Elijah just to give it more heft, yeah, that's interesting too, but, you know, we don't have to agree with any of this. As a matter of fact, if you look through the Talmud, there's tons of disagreements. 80% of it is disagreements, if I remember correctly.
Is it that low?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you want to say something, Joe?
No, I did. I think this is another one of those cases where these people have this idea, and then they go back and try and find some way to support their idea. And their idea may or may not be right. It may or may not be just. It may or may not be totally consistent with what somebody else thinks our religion preaches or teaches.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes. Babylon and Talmud Tractate Chagigah, page 5a. This is the next source. Rabbi Yochanan, when he came to the following verse, wept. Quote, behold, he putteth no trust in his holy ones. End quote. And that's a difficult verse to hear. Mm-hmm. And it relates to things we've been talking about for the past few minutes. Because if you are trying to be righteous, trying to do the right thing, endeavoring to fulfill God's will, and you come to a verse that says, God doesn't trust, God doesn't give credence to, God doesn't accept his holy ones, the righteousness of the righteous, then why am I doing it? And what's the point? If it doesn't mean something to God, well, why should I continue my life? So this verse was very difficult for Rabbi Yochanan to hear, and he wept. And Rabbi Yochanan explained,
I don't give a fig.
If he does not put his trust in his holy ones, in whom will he put his trust? Does it mean that God is totally arbitrary? He doesn't trust those who are closest to him? So who does he trust? Who does he lean on? Who does he support? Who does he reward? No one? So Rabbi Yochanan is suffering with a theological issue. Does God care about people who do good? Does he trust at all the righteous? Does he give them any reward at all? Does anything matter? One day, he was going on a journey, Rabbi Yochanan, and saw a man gathering figs. He was leaving those that were ripe, leaving them on the tree, and he was taking those that were unripe and putting them in his bag for the journey. Doesn't make any sense. So he said to him, are not those better? He says, why are you putting the unripe ones in your satchel and leaving the ripe ones? It doesn't make any sense. He replied, I need those for a journey. These will keep, but the others will not keep. Right? If figs, when they're ripe, they really are very mushy and very wet. They couldn't be put in the bag. They wouldn't last for more than a few hours.
No shelf life.
Right. I'm taking the ones with a shelf life because it's a long journey, and they will gradually ripen as I am walking. Said Rabbi Yochanan, ah, this is the meaning of the verse. Behold, he putteth no trust in his holy ones. Very enigmatic
note
passage.
14.
Yeah, 14 is really good.
Yeah. So life is a journey, says Rabbi Yochanan. Mm-hmm. And when I look around in this journey, it looks like God puts no trust in his holy ones. The righteous don't seem to be rewarded by God. They don't seem to have a longer life. They don't seem to have anything better. Why? Why not? And then when he sees this guy gathering figs, he understands why in life's journey does God seem not to reward the righteous. But the opposite of the case, God doesn't take the righteous on the journey. He specifically seems to take the unrighteous on the journey. And the righteous die early. The righteous seem to suffer. The righteous don't seem to be allowed on the journey. And he understands now that the righteous are too righteous for the journey. They're too ripe for the journey. They're too good. Now, what does that mean? I'm adding something into it now, but it's my only effort to understand, and it's connected to this footnote number 14 here. Apparently, the righteous are too pure, they're too naive, they're too perfect, and they're not fitting to the journey of life. They'll spoil, they'll be debased, they'll be overwhelmed by the evil, they'll be broken when they see what the real world is really about, so God saves them from the suffering of this life by taking them early. That seems to be what... But again, please, Harry, don't ask yourself, do I accept this or not? But try and enter into the mindset of Rabbi Yochanan and try and understand what he's grappling with and see how the answer means something to him.
But if they said, in both this and the other one, that they're talking about every now and then we have a righteous person that really isn't righteous, they're talking in a collective basis. They're talking about all righteous, and that's why I don't buy it. Would you see my point? If the discussion was that here's a bunch of people that are righteous, but who says that all of them are really righteous? So they're treating them as a collective unit. And if they discuss this to where there are people who may can be considered righteous but really aren't righteous, and that's the reason why they're cut down when they're young.
That was one approach that we saw already. But this is a different approach.
Sense, but not the way they put it.
Okay.
I'm losing my voice.
Yes. Jay wanted to speak.
I think the interpretation here is backwards again. Because
I understand
using this analogy, it's opposite to exactly what this has said. It depends upon what you think the journey is. Because the right ones, that is those with wisdom that are good and so forth, are allowed to live because they're still on the tree. And they're allowed to fulfill their biologic intent to become ripe, live a little bit longer on the tree, and then fulfill their destiny, fall off, make seeds, or whatever. But it's the other ones that are taken on the journey. That is the unripe ones, correct?
Right.
So that the righteous, you might say, are those that were rewarded by being allowed to live.
But how do you understand the text? How does it explain the verse?
You, as soon as you pluck the small ones off, the unripe ones off, they're not being taken on God's journey. They're being killed right there.
But how does that explain the verse? How do you understand the text? Again, Rabbi Yochanan is weeping over a verse, and then he understands the verse.
Well,
I think that his example is a poor example of what he believes.
Who's Rabbi Yochanan's example?
Yeah. The fig tree and the implication of what is the right good thing for the fig. Stay on the tree, as Jay says, or to be plucked off so that you can support life during the journey. So,
It's the presumption that being killed early by removing the younger figs or whatever is part of God's journey. But I would say that's...
But are you objecting to the text or reinterpreting the text?
I'm just saying that the text says that he's taking My understanding of that line is that by taking the unripe ones, that they will last longer for the journey, which is
that's not true.
The rabbi says is God's journey, our journey along with God. right?
It's the journey of life.
But it's not the journey of life, because as soon as they're removed from the tree, they're killed.
So you don't like the metaphor?
I think the metaphor is wrong. It's not that I don't like it, because the reward doesn't go to those that are removed from the tree. The reward goes to those that are left on the tree.
Okay, that's a question. I understand the metaphor.
And they propagate.
Yeah.
They fulfill the mitzvah.
Okay, so you're not reinterpreting the text. You're objecting to the way the text uses the metaphor.
Exactly.
Okay, but as far as the idea, let's understand the idea. The idea is that God is doing a favor to the righteous when he takes them young.
And he tests them.
He's not testing them. He's saving them from the future. Let me give you an example of the way I have heard this applied in our generation. And again, Harry and everyone else, I'm not telling you my opinion. I'm telling you things I've heard. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm trying to help us to understand different mindsets, different ways of looking at this. I've heard it said, for example, concerning the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir, Meirajin, who died, if I'm not mistaken, in 1935, that God took him in order to save him from seeing the Holocaust. Stephanie, I didn't say.
I didn't
it's
say
my opinion.
I just breathe heavily.
Now, without asking yourself, do you like this statement or not like it, but just trying to understand the inner logic.
Yes.
The inner logic is that God cares. There is hashgacha pratit. There is individual providence. And sometimes death can be a blessing to save you from what would happen. I know of other cases in which people apply this. Someone dies, and a few years later, the whole family is wiped out in a terrorist attack, God forbid. People say the person died, God took him so he wouldn't have to see what was going to happen to his children. That's the idea that this text is trying to communicate. Poor Jay, he's suffering
logical,
today.
Because what God should do would be to prevent the terrorist attack.
I understand.
So then the rabbi wouldn't have to see it.
You're right. You're right. I understand.
Jay leave the rabbi alive, so maybe he could have saved his family. Yeah.
There are a lot of reasons.
Yeah. You know, could this
also be an explanation? The old fig is fixed in its ways. The young fig that is picked off the tree
and killed.
No. The young fig that is picked off the tree will be guided through a long and healthy life and led down the proper path to be to carry forth the good message.
To be a real good, delicious fig.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Now look.
You know, just like Tevye and Fiddle the Roof, you know, says, could you give me a small fortune, smite me, you know. It's the same kind of a philosophy there. It's a way to obviate the circumstance that you're in. Mm-hmm. When you don't have an answer, you know, you come up with something obtuse.
Okay.
And you come up with something that's so obtuse that you say,
I understand. I really do.
You know, the trouble I have with the two examples that you gave from modern times is that if there's an afterlife, and I think the example about the Chafetz Chaim had to be accompanied by a leaf from the afterlife. That means that the afterlife is completely divorced from this world and does not comprehend or see what's going on in this world.
You're right. You're probably right.
Okay, let's discuss global warming next time, guys.
I'd like to see one more source in order to...
Rick Perry for that.
I wanted to do most Jews believe in an afterlife?
It's another subject. I'd like to see one more source, perhaps to make everyone feel better. Many of you didn't like the sources we saw today. Here's one that I think we've mentioned in the past. Let's learn it as the last source for today. Midrash Rabbah, Genesis, the Lord trieth the righteous. That's a verse from Psalms. Rabbi Yochanan said, a potter does not test defective vessels. He cannot give them a single blow without breaking them. Similarly, the Holy One, blessed be He, does not test the wicked, but only the righteous. Thus, the Lord trieth the righteous. So here we have a statement of, again, why the righteous particularly suffer. God is testing them to see if they could stand it. And He doesn't test the non-righteous because He knows they couldn't take it.
They have feet of clay.
Very good. Now, of course, this approach doesn't explain why God would want to test the righteous. Doesn't God know?
Right. Why,
so the next way they look at it explains. The same thing with a different metaphor. Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Hanina said, when a flax worker knows that his flax is of good quality, the more he beats it, the more it improves and the more it glistens. But if it is of inferior quality, he cannot give it one knock, but it splits. Similarly, the Lord does not test the wicked, but only the righteous. As it says, the Lord trieth the righteous. This is a new idea that we've mentioned, I think, but not seen in sources. And the idea is that the depth of life, the meaning of existence, can only be ascertained by those who have challenges in life. It's only through the pain and it's only through the difficulties that we reach a level of sensitivity, we reach a level of depth to our personalities.
That's paralleled by the example we used last year from Exodus, from Egypt being in the...
Yes, of course. It probably, to me, is the simplest explanation for most of the book of Genesis, certainly for the life of Abraham, who was always tested by God. As I like to say, the test is not to see how he will react and how he will act. It's in order to steel him, to make him, to improve him, to mold him, to help him become the Abraham that he could be.
But he doesn't die.
He doesn't die. And Mo is right. This is not an explanation of why the righteous die. It's an explanation of why they suffer, but not why they die. And I think we've said in this class, perhaps I've said in other classes, that I actually would like to remember why I've said this so many times, that on a certain level you can say that suffering is the greatest blessing. And how many people do we know who have said after the fact, not before it, but after it, that cancer was the greatest thing that could ever have happened to me? I've heard so many people say that. That I wouldn't have wanted to have been without it. That it made me into a better person. I saw things I didn't see. I was in situations, and I learned empathy. I learned understanding. I
Which
came
of your
in contact
really loved you?
with the depth of my own personality, and I learned that I could do things that I would never have thought that I could ever do. Jay,
just a comment. Again, the fault of these analogies is that strength doesn't equate to righteousness for the ox, and glistening doesn't equate to righteousness for the flax. So what I'm saying is that to put, I mean, the quality in this thing was to put the yoke on the strong is not saying which is the more righteous cow or ox, rather.
The one that can take it.
I'm saying that the fault of this is to make the assumption, because you're mixing the metaphor so much, that it doesn't exactly convey what I think that we're interpreting or attempting to interpret.
So just stay with the middle metaphor about the flax.
Yes.
It's only that flax which is better has the possibility of becoming even better. So if you have a group of 10 people, 5 of them are mediocre, 5 of them are great. God says those great people can be even better if they will suffer some setbacks in their life. And therefore God tests them. He gives them hard knocks for their own good.
Okay.
You mean that which does not kill me makes me stronger?
Yes. Yes, yeah, Stephanie.
What can't break me can only make you
stronger. You can say that if you have a precious stone,
I'm enough character,
that you can make it better by gently polishing it.
Yeah.
To make it better, as opposed to beating it in two and crushing it
to death.
I mean, that one in a way would make more sense, I would think.
But as far as the reality goes, I think we all know that there's a deep truth here.
No.
That
no.
through
no.
adversity.
No.
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 No, I believe that is true.
I do think that's true. I've heard that. I've had dozens of times people say, I have much more appreciation for life. I have more empathy.
Up to a certain point.
I've heard that dozens of times.
Except for those that don't commit suicide because they can't take it anymore.
Right. You're right. Up to a certain point, like Chip said. Right.
Those that don't survive.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, obviously, I didn't hear someone.
And this, so don't understand this source as trying to explain all suffering. Understand this source as trying to explain some suffering.
I've never heard anybody who didn't survive say that they felt better because of it.
Well, I have. I don't see it makes you feel any better. You survived cancer.
People that didn't survive have told you something?
Well, they did. Yes, they talked to us on Saturday night.
Yeah, actually, I now remember that. Jim, I remember that we once had this discussion. You said that.
Is
it in this
week?
Class or in a different class?
Last week here.
I did another time. I said, yeah. Having cancer twice, I don't think it made me a better person.
No, it didn't. I have to tell you now.
Okay, so with that comment of Stephanie, which unfortunately was recorded.
He couldn't get me better. Leave the recording on.